Welcome to Financial Repression Authority's Roundtable Insight, where the best fund managers, economists, and industry leaders discuss the key investment issues and challenges in the current macroeconomic environment.
Hi, welcome to FRA's Roundtable Insight. This is Richard Benulli. Today we have Martin Barnes and Ira Harris. Martin worked for the Bank Credit Analyst, providing analysis of the economic and financial outlook. He's known for providing leading-edge research on a broad range of subjects relevant to investors. He's been quoted regularly in the press, spoke frequently at investment conferences. Prior to joining BCA, Martin spent 10 years as chief international economist with Wood Mackenzie, one of the top UK brokerage firms. And from 1973 to 1977, he was economist with the British Petroleum in London. Ira is independent trader, hedge fund manager, global macro consultant, trading foreign currencies, equities, bonds, and commodities for over 40 years. He was also CME director from 1997 to 2003 and a stint most recently. Welcome, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Great, I thought we'd begin with your thoughts on that, Martin, with macro thoughts on the global economy, and you know, specifically if you wanted to do a focus on the UK and European continent economies.
Well, how about if I said I thought everything was just peachy and rosy and things couldn't be better? It would be nice to be able to say that, wouldn't it? Unfortunately, yeah. Of course, that is not exactly the case. It looks pretty grim, doesn't it? I mean, there's not much else that could go wrong at this point. We've got inflation, we've got all the economic indicators heading south, we've got market volatility. It's pretty ugly. But is it more ugly than previous times? Probably not. There's a great tendency to think when things are bad like they are right now, oh my goodness, it's so uncertain, things have never been worse. Well, anybody like an Ira will know what I'm talking about here. Anybody who's been in the business for 40, 50 years, as I have, we've been through many crises and it's always ugly. I mean, I was in the UK in the early 70s when inflation was much higher than it was in the US, even double digits, labor unrest. We had the deep recession of 74-5, the worst since the 30s at that point. Then we had another deep recession in the 80s. We had the Volcker squeeze. We had third world debt problems. We had the 87 crash. We had, the savings and loan crisis. We've had, the tech bubble. The list goes on and on and on. So this is actually no worse than any of these other episodes. In some ways, it's not quite as bad because one would hope that the pandemic and the Ukraine conflict, as ugly and as unpleasant as they are temporary developments. And importantly, we don't have the massive leverage in the private sector, certainly the consumer sector, that we had, obviously, before the housing bubble burst. So we're going into what is likely to be a recession. I mean, whether it's technically a recession or not, I think is irrelevant. We have enough information to know that the economy is heading into a very weak period. But I don't see that it should be a sort of cataclysmic downturn, certainly not as bad as 08, 09. And when the economy weakens, we're going to see a big reversal in current inflation expectations. Inflation is the current concern du jour. Everybody's panicked and worried about inflation. It's a real issue, but inflation fears and expectations are going to decline sharply, in my view, over the coming year in response to economic weakness and hopefully, a big improvement in some of these supply side problems that we've been having. But just to add to the complexity, I see that as a temporary state of affairs, because my view is that inflation was heading higher, and I wrote a fair bit about this couple of years ago. Inflation was heading higher even before the pandemic. Policy has been too easy for too long. The conditions for inflation were building under the surface. It was showing up in equity prices and home prices rather than in consumer prices, but inevitably there was going to be leakage into consumer prices. And of course, the pandemic and the Ukraine conflict just accelerated it all and made it that much worse. Central banks, in my view, do not have the stomach to keep policy tight enough for long enough to squeeze inflation out of the system. Powell is talking tough at the moment at the Fed, and more rate hikes are coming, and he's going to raise rates enough to slow the economy down. But once the economy slows, you'll be shocked at how quickly he backs off. He's not Volcker. We're not going into another Volcker era where the monetary screws are going to get tightened for a long time. The Fed will back off quickly and inflation will come bubbling back. Maybe not, it won't be as high as it's been right now because we won't have this Ukraine supply side issue, but we're not going back to 2% inflation. The new base will be 3 to 4, which is not end of the world, but it's higher than the markets are discounting long run, and higher than the Fed wants. They say they want 2, but they won't have the courage to get us there.
And any thoughts on the time frame on when the Fed could change, or major central banks could change policy?
Start easing again, you mean?
Yeah.
Oh, God. I mean, they're still tightening, so it's not going to be for a while. They'll lag, they will be preemptive easy. They'll be slow they'll be a bit late in easing. They won't necessarily be slow, but they'll be a bit late. I would say by, certainly the second half, into the second half of next year, you'll see expectations about interest rates and inflation very different to what they are now.
Okay, interesting. And your thoughts, Ira?
Well, just from picking up what Martin talked about, so I would posit this question back. Does the heavy debt load that exists in the world today, is a lot of dollar denominated debt, especially because of the policies of the US Central Bank in and out over the last decade and certainly over the previous 2 years, and the huge massive amount of dollar based debt load in the world, which, I was just talking with somebody else, and that Volcker couldn't really be Volcker in today's debt laden world. And that, could he have raised rates to those types of levels to squeeze inflation out without absolutely bringing the global economy into a depression? Well, I mean, we have enormous debt levels, and to me, the critical point still remains: can any central bank raise interest rates, overnight interest rates, short-term interest rates, to where they are a real positive yield, or will we remain in negative yields for so long and that continue to buoy asset prices? That's what concerns me. So.
That's a really good point and a good issue and a really fascinating one. So I kind of agree with you up to a point, that it limits how high interest rates have to go and will go. But when you talk about high debt, excessive debt, we've got to decide, be a bit more clear what debt we're talking about. So the worrying debt is debt that is used to collateralize assets when the price of those assets fall, i.e. mortgage debt in 2007, 2008, when house prices fall, you've got a banking crisis. Household debt, if we're talking about the US, is not that high. I mean, there was significant deleveraging, from 2010 onwards. So the sort of household debt to income ratio is back down to, you know, more moderate levels. Corporate debt is, you know, tended to be quite high. A lot of that corporate debt has been used for financial engineering purposes, share buybacks, etc., M&A. But the coverage ratio is pretty good for the corporate sector. Where debt is incredibly high, and we're talking the developed economies here, we can talk about emerging markets in a moment, is government debt. So we have got wartime levels of government debt to GDP. We've never seen levels like this during peacetime. But that's much less worrying than private debt. You know, if private debt gets too high and people can no longer afford to service that debt, then you've got a banking crisis. And we saw that, of course, in spades in 08 and 09. If government debt is too high, well, you know, that's a different kettle of fish. I mean, they're not borrowing from the banks. That doesn't lead to a banking crisis. You can always have the central bank step in and buy the bloody stuff if the private investors want. I mean, pardon my language. What's interesting to me is, you know, we've had this extraordinary rise in government debt for the last several years. Well, really, it was the 08, 09 crisis where it really triggered, you know, Obama, you know, pumped billions in. He had to, of course, to save the system. And then we had more fiscal stimulus, you know, with the last government. And then the pandemic, even more fiscal stimulus. So we've got huge amounts of government debt, debt GDP ratio heading to 100% and staying there as far as the eye can see. Don't expect politicians to do anything about it, because the only way to bring government debt down is to run budget surpluses, and that's impossible. You would have to cut spending, massively, raise taxes. No politician's going to do that. Don't expect the voters to actually care that much, because they're the beneficiaries of the spending and the lower taxes. Tell voters that you're going to cut their social security payments, or they're going to, you know, stop repairing their roads, et cetera, et cetera. They'll be pretty unhappy. So who are the policemen on fiscal policy? Who actually forces governments to run their house in order? The financial markets, the bond market. You know, remember Clinton's guy, you know, if I come back, I want to come back as the bond market so I can intimidate everyone. So the bond investors have known about these trends in government debt for years now, and they don't care. You know, they're the financial policemen, you know, and they're in the equivalent of the financial coffee shop eating donuts. I mean, we've had bond yields at extraordinarily low levels, despite levels of government debt that scare the likes of you and me. But if the bond market doesn't care, don't expect anybody else to. So the issue would be, when will bond investors start to care about government debt? At some point, I suppose they will. And if you get inflation coming back and you've got high government debt levels and monetary tightening, that looks like a recipe for bond investors to head for the hills. Hasn't really happened yet, but you know, that's a risk out there. But I don't worry so much about excessive government debt as I do about excessive private sector debt. Now, you have a lot of debt in the emerging world. Now, that's a different, that is worrying, because, you know, you could easily have another emerging market crisis if they can't service that debt. You know, the dollar's been a very strong currency. A lot of their debt is dollar denominated. Their economic outlook is not great. So these are fragile economies. So that's a risk. That's something to keep on your radar screen. But don't worry too much about US government debt or European government debt, because their backstop is always going to be the central banks. They're not going to default on it. So they don't go bust. Governments don't go bust. Private individuals and corporations can go bust if they've got too much debt.
So looking at the emerging markets, so I mean, we've seen this before, and you and I have lived through it many times, but if the dollar is too strong, and it's more of a problem now, I think, because of the effects of course, the Fed, for as long as they have, in which they've more than ever facilitated the borrowing of dollars by keeping U.S. rates far too low for too long on a real yield basis. I mean, nothing stems money slowdown than real yields. And we know that we have not seen positive real yields for, it all depends whose data you want to use, but we know it's been a long time and it's been severe. So now they're saddled with it. So is, in your estimation, would you see that the rising dollar is really problematic for the global financial system and the Fed really should be more attentive to it?
Well, it is problematic for any countries that have a lot of dollar denominated debt, and if their currencies are weak against the dollar, then of course that debt servicing is going to cost them a lot more. And yeah, so there is a lot of emerging market dollar denominated debt owed by fragile economies. So that is an issue. Should the Fed care about it? The Fed doesn't, you know, what could the Fed do? I mean, time and time again, you know, we have seen the Fed will always focus on what is right for the US. They might care about what that implies for other economies, but that is not their problem. You know, they will always take the attitude, you know, if raising rates in the US to slow our overheated economy causes you problems because it means our dollar goes up and your currency goes down, then you better do something about that at your end. Don't expect us to keep our interest rates down to help your currency. And I think that's appropriate. All central banks are focused on their domestic economy. They only care about global issues to the extent that they rebound back, you know, on their domestic scene. So if the Fed thought that global instability was going to have some serious implications for the US financial system, then it would care. But if it just creates some havoc for some unfortunate foreign economies, that's their problem. So it's a very sort of nationalistic approach that central banks have. And I suppose that's the right approach as well. So it's tough enough trying to get things right for your own economy without trying to figure out, you know, how you should be helping anybody else.
But when they instituted the standing repo facility, which to me probably measures when you crawl through the intricacies of it, that it has about a $2 trillion facilitation to it with enough flexibility. Do you think that gives them a false sense of being able to resolve any potential global dollar crunch?
No, I don't think so. Okay. I think they're I think that, you know, a central bank always has to sound confident. I mean, God help the markets if you ever had a sort of central bank official looking panicked and saying, oh my God, you know, the world's terrible, I don't know what we can do about it. So they always have to sound as if everything's under control and, you know, they know how to deal with all the problems. But I think they're sufficiently smart enough to know that they've only got limited control over what goes on in the world. I mean, over my many years, I got quite close to the Fed. I went to Jackson Hole 18 times. So I spent a lot of time talking to governors and regional presidents. And, you know, when you get them alone, they're quite humble. You know, they're not arrogant in terms of they think that they've got all the answers to the problems. They don't, and they know they don't. And when you look back at the Fed's record, even economically, they have failed to forecast every recession in the last 50 years, which is no worse than anybody else, by the way. Nobody else did any better than that. So, yeah, they have to be humble. I think they, but they can't, they've got to come across as confident.
as Winston Churchill would say, they have much to be humble about. So, I mean, that satisfies that. But yeah, but the only difference between the Fed and everybody else is that in order to institute policy, they make such enormous bets, like the balance sheet buildup. It's an enormous bet on them being right, I think, because how do you unwind it? There's no exit strategy. So how do they actually step back from this? And we're finding it out now. So,
yeah, I guess they did what they thought they had to do to keep the financial system functioning. They probably would argue that they didn't want to take any risks. Better to do too much than too little, and we'll worry about dealing with the consequences later. I mean, I don't know what the right analogy would be. It's like the building on fire, so you just turn the hoses on, flood the bloody thing, and if the basement floods, you know, too bad, and that might weaken the structure of the building if the water stays in the basement long enough, but you'll hopefully pump it back out before the building falls down. But the current imperative is to put the fire out. So they've just been putting fires out, you know, with the 08, 09 meltdown and then the pandemic. And, you know, I mean, the balance sheet, I always took the view that it was zero interest rates that was really the most important part of what the Fed was doing, rather than the blowing up the balance sheet. It's not clear to me that the balance sheet, obviously it kept it suppressed yields because they were taking a lot of product off the market, but I think it was even if they hadn't done QE, let's say, but they kept interest rates at zero and told the market, we are keeping interest rates at zero for years. Do you not think that there would have been enough private buying of those bonds that the Fed, you know, wouldn't have bought? If the Fed hadn't bought them, do you not think other people would have bought them? Because if short rates are zero and bond yields are somewhere between 1 and 2, that's pretty attractive. If you know that short rates aren't rising for a long, long time. So clearly it distorted the market and it affected spreads and all the rest of it. I'm not saying that QE didn't have any impact at all. But to me, it's been the zero rate policy of the Fed that's been supporting markets more than the balance sheet. So unwinding the balance sheet doesn't terrify me that much, to be honest. I may be wrong in that.
So quantitative tightening, I mean, even as Powell has said, you know, and I've read some of the Fed studies, but he was citing the one where 100 billion of quantitative tightening, maybe a quarter point interest rate rise. And he said, but I wouldn't hang my hat on that either, because it could be more, it could be, you know, so.
They don't know. Yeah.
No, they don't know.
They don't know. They don't know. And again, that's one thing I did learn about the Fed with all the years I spent talking to them and visiting with them. We tend to assume central banks know a lot more than us. You know, they've got a lot of smart people working for them. They've got access to information that maybe we can't have access to. And you tend to assume that they're much wiser and better informed, which hopefully they are. But when it comes to the really, really big questions, I've definitely learned that they don't know any more than we do. You know, when will house prices fall? You know, when are these supply disruptions going to ease? Blah, blah. All the, you know, the big macro questions, they're as much in the dark as the rest of us. And I found I had mixed feelings about that. On the one hand, it made me feel quite good. It said, oh, gosh, I know just as much as these guys, you know, they're no better than me. But then I thought, but hang on, they're running monetary policy. I need them to know more than me. I wish they did know more than me. I wish they did have the answers to these questions if they're twiddling the dials. So it's a bit scary that, you know, they're as much in the dark about some of these big questions as we are, but they don't know because they've never been here before with this QE and QT. So, you know,
yeah, so
they can do all this, they can do all their fancy economic modeling and studies that they like, but that's not going to give them the answers.
No, it hasn't. And I'm with you where it goes from here. And that's why we're all groping, meaning investors and traders, trying to figure this out and actually staying a step ahead of them, which ought not to be possible, but seems to be possible because they are truly the giant aircraft carrier that when it tries to turn causes a lot of...
Okay, but so let me ask you a question. I mean, you've got all this experience of trading and in the markets. I mean, what are you looking for to identify a bottom? I mean, obviously you've got sentiment indicators. You want everybody to be massively bearish if you want to be a contrarian. So you want the thing to be completely washed out. Presumably you want assets to be relatively cheap, you know, at the bottom. You want people to be too bearish about the outlook. And those would all be classic kind of signs of a bottom, extreme bearishness, cheap values, etc. Do you think we're close to that?
You know, of course. And do I think we're close to it? I don't know, but when I come to valuations, if real yields can't get positive, then I think the answer is yes, because we will never see what we saw again with Volcker and others, and even Greenspan, when Greenspan to me had somewhat market integrity. I would start to question it at some point, probably with the long-term capital management bailout, I think was a terrible situation for Greenspan. I think he panicked and it set up a lot of bad monetary policy going forward that we paid for. But if real yields can't get positive, and I'm talking about on the short end, because that's where, to me, central banks really have their impact. Then I think asset prices will again reassert themselves sooner than most people believe. Because it becomes, how do I protect? You know, everybody with wealth is looking for ways to protect wealth. And what's my best investment? As we talked about, bonds, you know, it's even when German yields on 10 years go to 2%. Yeah,
negative nominal yields. I know. I can't get my head around negative nominal yields.
I know, but you know, it's almost like, as we would say in the States, the Fed ran interference and the ECB just took office. Yes, they could go, well, there's no going to be no change here, and I can go and parade around this. And okay, we'll see where it goes. Well, we're seeing where it goes, and of course, the bond losses. Of course, if you don't realize the bond loss, you'll hold it to bond expirations, and you'll get your money back, whatever the value, whatever its underlying value will be. But you will get if you have $1 million bond, you'll get $1 million back if you hold it to expiration. But if you're forced into any type of liquidation at this time, everybody's sitting on massive losses. And I actually kind of enjoyed Powell yesterday when he talked about going, well, yeah, we're going to have losses, especially if we start to sell some of the MBS into the market. But don't forget, we sent you $1 trillion in interest earnings and gains over the last 2 years. So we're kind of working off a positive book here, which I think surprised a lot of idiots in Congress who were busy touting the free money when it was coming from the Fed their way and go, wow, this is great. We got money for the highway fund. Well, somebody's going to pony up here and absorb some of these losses, I believe. But it's still, I think that Felix Zuloff saw this very well, too, that the second half of the year, because, as you say, they will give ground long before they get to their inner Volcker, and that will make assets desirable. Right now, you know, I think Powell's doing exactly what he told people he was going to do 2 months ago, which is we have to destroy demand through wealth destruction because we don't have any tools to curb the supply bottlenecks.
Right.
And there's a lot of wealth destruction taking place right now, which I think is leading to demand destruction in a very quick fashion. And again, I think that the Fed has a very poor record of getting active in with monetary policy into an election. And I think that there's enough politics, probably more so than we've seen in a long time at the Fed. We've got a few new governors, and we have people who may not want to be as disruptive about the elections because they're not interested in Congress turning over as dramatically as some others, you know. So I think there's going to be a lot of politics. I really don't look for the Fed to raise rates after the summer, which is not to me a bad thing because we need to see what the impact of quantitative tightening is going to be. I was fascinated that they went by $47.5 billion up to September on the quantitative tightening because I think they learned some lessons from 2018. I think the second half of 2018 scared Powell because he went, as Stanley Druckenmiller would say, on a double shotgun approach by quantitative tightening and raising rates. And the impact was far greater than I think he had been led to believe it would be. So if they raise rates and stop at 2%, 2.25%, and then let quantitative tightening, I don't think that that's necessarily a bad thing. I think it would actually be a good thing because we don't, as you say, and I agree wholeheartedly with you, we don't know. We've never been here before. And they're groping in the dark too.
Yeah. I mean, we don't really have any serious economic heavyweights running the Fed anymore like you used to have. You know, in the old days, there was, you know, Greenspan, of course, was a serious economist. There was people like Don Cohen there. Yeah. There was a lot of economic heavyweight thinkers. We don't have that at the Fed these days. There's some banking expert, regulatory kind of people, much more political, as you say. So that might make a difference.
I'm glad you bring up Don Cohen, who I think was probably the best of the best here. And had Greenspan held any sway with the Bush family, we probably would have seen Don Cohen be the Fed chair, but I don't think they were going to let Greenspan pick his successor. No. The Bushes were not fans of Greenspan. They had to live with him, but they hold him accountable for Bush one loss.
That's right. Read my lips. Yeah, right.
Yeah, right. So, yeah. So I've got, yeah, Don Cohen, one of my favorites.
Yeah, he's a good guy.
His speeches were unbelievable. You know, I still go back and read them because they were so filled. But, you know,
I actually had a Zoom meeting with him a couple of weeks back, actually, just to touch base with him. And yeah, I discovered an old speech of his where he talked about inflation, how little the Fed really understood inflation.
I think I have that one from 2004. His speeches were great. And I went to actually hear him speak once at Northwestern University. And it was just unbelievable. He spoke for 2 hours and it was worth listening to for 2 hours. I was really sorry he wasn't
given. Anyway, Richard, we've rambled a lot here. And you originally asked about, you know, what are we thinking about macro outlook? So I guess you're getting a flavor of that we don't think it's great at the moment.
Okay. And just like if you can elaborate a bit more, like you've written recently on inflation and how, what are your thoughts on the dynamics playing out over the next 6 to 18 months, you know, from global?
Well, as I said, I think it's going to come off quite sharply, you know. not every aspect of, obviously we don't know what oil prices are going to do, like, you know, put those aside, but even oil prices can't keep going up the way they had been going up. So whether they've peaked or not, I don't know, but the rate of increase of oil is going to change, you know, for the better. One part of the CPI that's going to get worse, and it's an important part, is rent inflation. You know, so when they collect inflation data, basically you've got a bunch of people just going around the stores writing down prices of eggs and milk and televisions and, you know, diapers and whatever, all the things that go into the CPI. They take note of the prices every week, I suppose they do it. But for rent, they only do this kind of once every few months or every 6 months. They do a kind of survey, and it's very lagged, the data. And I think the data currently shows rent inflation is running at like 6%. But if you actually read industry studies, there's one I came across by, you know, a company called rent.com or something. They were arguing that rent is rising nationally at an average rate of 25%, you know. So at some point, the data is going to catch up with reality. So even if the energy inflation comes down, food price inflation moderates, we've already seen a peaking in vehicle prices. They've been actually, used car prices were crazy for a while. They've now been declining. Rent inflation is going to go up, and that's got by far the biggest weighting in the CPI. So it might be a little bit sticky for a while, but it's going to come down, and inflation expectations will come down as the economy weakens. And as I said, hopefully these supply side issues are going to get better. There's already signs that the supply disruptions are easing. You know, shipping rates have come down. The Purchasing Managers Deliveries Index, you know, that kind of tracks, you know, how long deliveries are taking, that's showing an improvement. So the supply side should get better. Inflation will come down. People will breathe a big sigh of relief over the next 6, 12 months. But before we get to the end of next year, as I said, I think, you know, we'll see a bottom, and there'll be starting to edge higher again, because the Fed will have backed off and inflation won't have come down to where the Fed would really like it to come down to, which is 2%. It's not going to get back to that. And of course, wage growth might prove quite sticky as well. I mean, the labor market is extraordinarily tight. What, there's twice as many vacancies as there are unemployed people. I mean, that's really unusual, to say the least. And that will improve as the economy slows, of course. The number of vacancies will come down. But even so, the labor market is likely to stay relatively tight, given what's going to happen to the rest of the economy. So wage growth might be a bit sticky as well, coming down. It's interesting in the UK at the moment. I'm speaking to you from Scotland. That's where I relocated to, gone home back to Scotland. We've got a wave now of strikes beginning in the public sector, sort of reminiscent of what I lived through back in the 70s before Thatcher came in and crushed the unions. You know, we've just begun a series of rail strikes, but doctors are talking about going on strike, teachers are talking about going on strike, lawyers, barristers are talking about going on strike over pay. So this is a kind of a new thing that's just happening here, because inflation's running close to double digits, and, you know, pay offers have been lagging massively behind inflation for years. So people are getting a bit antsy about that. So inflation is definitely, I think, the era of surprisingly low inflation is over. We're not going back to the 70s, because that was a very different world, pre-globalization, all the rest of it. But, you know, inflation is going to surprise on the downside in the short run, and then surprise by coming back again quite quickly after that. The piece I'm writing on inflation is called Inflation Whipsaw Ahead.
I see. And what about the effects, how do you, of like geopolitical risk? How do you factor that in your vision, like, what's happening in Russia, Ukraine, on the sanctions and potential evolution of the war there?
Like all of us, we are spectators, aren't we? And this, all we can do is watch the news and see what the heck's going on. And I don't know what's going to happen there. I mean, it can't go. It's not going to. Some aspects of it won't. I mean, the war itself or the conflict might go on. Some people are saying it could go on for years. What won't go on for years is the impact on energy and food prices. One of my favorite economic quotes of all time, and Ira will know this one, of course, was from the late Herb Stein. If something is unsustainable, it will stop, basically, is to paraphrase what he said. So the trend that we've seen in energy prices and the disruption to food supplies, the blocking of grain exports, et cetera, from Ukraine, is unsustainable. Therefore, it won't be sustained by definition. If it's unsustainable, it can't be sustained. So something will change on that front. We'll crank up oil supplies from out, to replace what's lost from Russia. And they'll find some way to ease the blockade of Ukrainian grain exports. I mean, I've seen one argument that they should send the US fleet into the Black Sea to unblock, to stop the blockade of the ports there. Something will have to happen because that's heading for a sort of a global food crisis with huge humanitarian consequences. So something has to be done on that front. But as to the other aspects, the war itself, I have no idea how that's going to play out. But I think the inflation consequences of it will diminish.
Interesting. And your thoughts, Ira?
No, we don't know how that's going to play out, and I agree. I agree on the food crisis. The only thing is that the world, to me, should have or could have, with the IMF and the World Bank and the World Food Bank, they should have just the IMF, which is always got their finger on trying to issue more SDRs. They should be issuing SDRs to purchase grain su supplies all over the world to ensure the emerging markets. Because I think the real crisis, and it's going to be a political crisis on top of it, exists in the emerging markets between the higher dollar and the higher food costs. This is this ha this bodes for a catastrophe. And if you're not willing to take on the Russian fleet by engaging the Russians directly, you must, and Martin, I believe is 100% right. Herb Stein is right. It can't go on. Those grains will come out of there, but in the short term, you have to secure to make sure to ease the crisis that is building in Africa and Latin. These are real crises, and this comes on the top, of record harvests for the previous years. It's not like the world hasn't been producing enough grain. We've not been in drought, and we've not. The world has had record food crops between Brazil, the United States, very good. Now you have of course a lack of fertilizer, so you really are in the throes of a perfect storm for a global food crisis between lack of shipments and lack of fertilizer to enhance the production where you can do the production. This is not, this has nothing good looking forward to it. So I agree with Martin. And how the Russian Ukraine war plays out, we don't know. We don't know. Does it widen? The United States is doing its best not to widen it. It doesn't want direct conflict with the Russians, and I can understandably so. The global costs will be enormous. So I think it's never to validate what the Russians have done, but you're going to have to sit down, and that's I think what my you're going to have to find a way to get this stuff moving. And some people are going to have to swallow a lot of pride, and okay, and but the crises that the world faces are just too enormous to even consider. Right? I mean, you have to consider them and you have to deal with them, but to really visualize them is difficult.
Well, it's been an interesting, fascinating discussion, gentlemen. Is there a way for our listeners to learn more about your current work, Martin, or are you more in a retirement phase?
Well, I'm not. I am writing the odd piece, but it's not really in the public domain. I'm writing a piece for my former employer, BCA Research, that will go out this month, but I guess that will just go to BCA clients. So
okay, sure. Okay. Okay,
so great. Yeah. You're going to be the Mr. X this year. No.
That's it. That's my alter ego.
always love that. But before we cut off, how do you see the ECB dealing with their problems? Because that's a political problem as much as they don't have to just worry about the economics, the politics.
Well, I mean, I guess they some degree in the same place as the Fed. I mean, inflation isn't as severe in the euro area as it is. It seems to be very much an Anglo-Saxon problem. You know, where are the inflation rates the highest? US, UK, and Canada. I'm thinking of the core inflation here. You know, core inflation in Italy is, I think the latest number is 2.5%. You know, it's even quite low in Greece, believe it or not, and France and Germany, it's a little bit over 3. In the US, we're talking 6, you know. So they don't have as big an inflation problem. They haven't had as big a run-up in asset prices. They haven't had the big run-up in house prices and equity prices that we saw in the US. They haven't had the same fiscal, you know, largesse that we've seen in the US. So in some sense, they're not in quite a bad a place. Obviously, their economies are not in great shape either. They're vulnerable to the supplies of energy, you know, being cut back from Russia. So that's a non-trivial issue for them. You know, their economies are going to get weak as well over the coming year because if ECB is raising rates, they just don't have to be as aggressive as the Fed. But, you know, it's a pretty uniform story throughout the developed world that inflation is higher than central banks want. And they're going to have to tighten monetary conditions they have to be seen to be responding to it, even if that has an economic cost. They can't just ignore it. But the outlook for the European economies, of course, is not great either. And if the US is going into a period of significant weakness, that's going to in itself hurt Europe, just given trade links, etc. So Europe has a lot of links with emerging economies for trade as well. So Europe has multiple challenges. But the ECB is generally tougher, you know, more anti-inflationary than the Fed has been historically. They take their inflation mandate a lot more seriously than the Fed. The Fed can always say, well, we've got a dual mandate. Yeah, we've got to keep inflation low, but we've also got to keep unemployment low. The ECB doesn't have that dual mandate problem. It can say we have a single mandate is to keep inflation down. You know, so they tend to be tougher, and you've got the historical DNA of the Bundesbank, you know, that still permeates the ECB.
But so do you think there's more room? Why, from everything you said, you think that there we'll see a massive or a genuine fiscal stimulus package in Europe to supplant whatever type?
No.
No?
I don't think so. Yeah. No. There's no pressure, momentum for that. given the damage that the pandemic did to the fiscal picture in the first place.
Yeah.
So no, I don't see this any pressure for fiscal easing anywhere, really. I mean, that might change, and once it's obvious that economic growth is much, much weaker, then there'll be some maybe fiscal response, but nobody wants to talk about that.
But they certainly have more room than the U.S. to maneuver, although they don't have the political apparatus.
Well, that's right, and they're still above or in a worse situation than the Maastricht targets. They're supposed to maintain strict fiscal discipline as part of the euro conditions, and they haven't been able to do that. So
and I believe in unicorns and fairies too, as well as the Maastricht 3% and 60% levels. Italy's they're eating enough for three countries based on that. So well, this has been for me great, so thank you.
Thank you very much.
It's been fun,
Ira. Thank you. Thanks so much. And
good to see you both.
Yes, thank you. Great. Thank you.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Thank you, Richard.
The FRA Roundtable Insight Show is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the show each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Any discussions among the panel participants or responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the panel participants and do not take into consideration the listener's suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Please be advised that you invest or speculate at your own risk.